This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The View from 22. I'm Freddie Gray, Deputy Editor of The Spectator. And in this week's episode, we'll be looking at child abuse, the potential candidates for the plum role of European Commissioner, and whether the National Theatre should continue to receive state funding. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Liz Davies, a frontline child protection social worker from London Metropolitan University, the historian and literary critic Kate Maltby, and from The Spectator, Matthew Paris, Lloyd Evans, James Forsyth, and Isabel Hardman. Thanks all for coming today. On to our first topic, the forthcoming inquiry into child abuse allegations concerning senior politicians as much as 30 years ago. Matthew, in your column this week, you suggest that there may be a rush to judgment going on, a rush to inquiry, certainly, and you call it, I think, an overheated conspiracy theory.
It seems to me very likely to be an overheated conspiracy theory. It's certainly heated. I think it's overheated. There's certainly a rush to judgment. You say concerning senior politicians 30 years ago. It may concern senior politicians 30 years ago. It may not. There may be no senior politicians involved in it at all. All we know is that Geoffrey Dickens, who was a delightful man, we all liked Geoffrey very much, but he was pretty nuts. He had his theories. He had lots of conspiracy theories, and he did believe that Britain was in the grip of a huge paedophile ring, and it involved very senior people in government. And I think it's highly unlikely that the Home Office would simply have willfully destroyed or burnt the documents that he gave to the then Home Secretary. I don't know. I don't say that we shouldn't look into it. I just think everybody needs to calm down a little bit.
I mean, you do address this concern in your piece, but we have heard sort of reticence about other inquiries, such as Hillsborough and things, which have ended up being entirely vindicated by the finding.
Yeah, but the Hillsborough inquiry mostly was an inquiry by the police into themselves, and that's never sufficient. I don't say that every inquiry ends a story, but I'm pretty sure that if there is now another inquiry into two previous inquiries, and if it doesn't find evidence of a huge conspiracy at the top of paedophiles, I don't believe that those people who think these conspiracies exist will be satisfied by this inquiry. They'll then want another inquiry. But you can't win discussions like this. I mean, with respect to Liz, it's very important that she does win this discussion, because the whole purpose of my article in The Spectator is that anyone who says, calm down, we don't need another inquiry, is always going to lose the discussion. And anyone who says, well, let's at least try and get to the truth of this matter, even if there's nothing in it, at least we need to lay this to rest, is always going to win the argument. And so you get inquiry upon inquiry upon inquiry.
Well, Liz, the pressure's on now. You've got to win. I mean, it doesn't seem that extravagant an argument Matthew's making. I mean, what he's saying is we really need to pause, reflect, maybe come back in a few weeks when the media storm has died down, and see if we really need an overarching inquiry into you
know. Well, it doesn't feel like a rush to me. I've waited 20 years since I was aware of major cover-ups and people interfering with my investigations when I was trying to protect children, and where instructions came from for those interferences, I don't know, so I want some answers.
You knew about these particular allegations?
I was investigating many, many allegations of sexual assaults of children and murders of children. I was working with the police. We were investigating. Suddenly, the police were taken off my investigations of the most serious crimes you could imagine against children, multiple numbers of children. I had to then go to civil courts, protect them however best I could, but there was no prosecutions of perpetrators. And I have only found out recently those police who were removed from the investigations I've now managed to contact in this day and age when you can contact people much more easily. And they've told me their instructions came from senior police, very senior level. Now, who's going to investigate that? I've no means of investigating why certain police at senior level shut down me investigating the murders of children. I want to know that. I'm getting on in years. I've waited 20 years for answers. I'm not going to stop trying to find the answers to such incredibly serious matters. A lot of the people who were involved are still around. They're still alive. Many of the people I was looking at are still in senior positions in children's services and so on.
Why do you think it is that we have to wait 30 years and then have an inquiry into these things?
Well, more information's come to light now, and through the internet, with social media, obviously a lot more victims and survivors have come forward than ever before. My inbox is full every day, people contacting me with stories to tell. And, you know, there's a limit, because our biggest problem now is police to investigate it. You know, I've only got Operation Firmly, 7 officers. They're overwhelmed.
So what you'd like is truly an overarching inquiry looking into not just politicians, but every single child abuse case that hasn't been solved, or that there hasn't been justice found.
People who, like myself, were investigating and where the investigations were shut down, I want answers to that. I don't know how I'm going to get answers. I've tried for 20 years. I've raised various things in the media. I've tried every which way and got nowhere. And, you know, when I've raised other aspects of investigation, we haven't been allowed to progress those. So I want to know who's behind it all, to put it simply. It's not all about politicians. It's about abuse of power at the highest level. And I want to know who those powerful people are.
Well, the highest level is obviously ministers, senior ministers. And you seem to me to be suggesting that these instructions came from senior ministers. I personally doubt it, but these things have happened, and I certainly can't say that it didn't. But when you say these investigations were shut down, that's not a very neutral word. Investigations are not proceeded with by the police every day of the week. All kinds of investigations are looked into and then not proceeded with. And you say they were shut down at the highest level, by which it was meant that a decision will have been taken by the police officer responsible, who will have been at a senior level, not to proceed with something. That there may be a sinister explanation for this, but it may just be that there wasn't sufficient evidence to proceed.
I've been working on cases for months. I'm a very experienced investigator, and I've worked with police for many years, and I know when my investigation of extremely serious crimes is closed down. When I go to work one day and I'm told by my senior manager, you will no longer have any police to work with on these investigations from this day on.
Could that be because there was a lack of evidence?
Absolutely not. We were in the middle of collating a mass of evidence. I had to get some children right out of London to secret venues to protect them. I was in, you know, the level of investigation was very, very high and very complex. So, you know, I knew exactly what I was dealing with. Children were being taken all over the country to be abused in different places by different people.
Do you have any confidence, though, that an inquiry would sort of put these matters to rest?
No, but I can ask some questions. I don't know where else to go. You know, I know certain people at certain times have said things, you know, but there's answers I want. I mean, very interesting, and I was in Islington, that Geoffrey Dickens, about 2 or 3 years before I was raising very serious issues, was himself raising issues there. That's another dossier that nobody's currently looking for. That didn't go to Leon Britton, that went to Douglas Hurd, Home Secretary.
All these children who have been, as you say, if they have been taken to secret locations to be abused by perhaps senior people, you will presumably be able to find some of the children to testify to this,
will you? Well, obviously, a lot of the ones I was working with are now adults.
Yes.
Of course. Yes, they will, of course, testify. But we need to have a lot of things in place for that. Support systems, witness protection. We have systems. We know exactly how to deal with this to protect people. We need witness protection in place. And an inquiry won't solve it, because it'll do so much. It'll get us a bit further. But what I've argued for 20 years is a national police investigation team, because we need somewhere that people can go to where they make the connections across the country. When I went to Scotland Yard with my evidence about Islington, I was then used by Scotland Yard to go all over the country to liaise with other investigations like North Wales and so on. But nobody was connecting it all up. And so I was hearing many names, many, many, everyone's pressing me now for names. I won't say any names. But every place I went to, I was hearing names of all kinds of people. And nobody's ever joined those dots up.
I won't ask you for names, but I will ask you, you do have names, do you, in your own head? And these are very senior people, people in the world of politics. And you are reasonably confident that they have been involved in some of these activities.
Well, some names like Cyril Smith has come out recently. It's no surprise to me, put it that way. And when he died, I was saying, I wonder if anything will come out now, you know, because I'd heard his name for many, many years.
So had I.
And,
and you're right, I hadn't entirely believed the stories, or I'd thought that whatever it was he'd done hadn't been very serious and had been exaggerated. So you are quite right, it is possible to be wrong about people, but that it's possible to be wrong about people doesn't mean that this great national conspiracy involving top people all over the country transporting children to secret locations, I would need a lot of convincing.
What we need is the proper police investigation into all the allegations that we know about that have been not investigated over the years, where investigations have been shut down at a certain point. My experience was you could do so much, you get to a certain level, and it all got shut down. And I've heard that time and again. So that's what we need. We need more police resources working with social workers. And if I can just say, what we're talking about is called organised abuse of children. And last year, this government got rid of all the statutory guidance. They got rid of the definition of organised abuse and all the means of investigating it. So, you know, to me, we're losing our tools
for the job. I'm not here to answer for ministers, but I don't think it's fair to say they got rid of all the means of investigating organised abuse.
They've got rid of the policy that stated how police and other agencies should investigate organised abuse
of children. But who are these senior police people who you say are consistently just shutting down every inquiry the moment you get to the point of proceeding? It strikes me unlikely in this day and age that a chief constable is going to shut down a case where there's good evidence of appalling abuse to children on the grounds that he or she is under pressure from some national network.
You have to ask them, don't you? I didn't function at that level. I don't know who these people are. All I can tell you is what I do absolutely know happened in my world of being paid to protect children and not being able to protect them in the way that I was expected to.
And on to politics. James, in your column this week, you suggest that the German politicians are getting quite anxious as to who David Cameron is going to choose for the European Commission.
Yes, so who is he going to nominate as Britain's European Commissioner? Now, the cynic in one might think that this is because the summit to decide the makeup of the next Commission is on the 16th, and Angela Merkel's 60th birthday is the next day, and the Germans just want to get everything done in good time, so she's home in time to blow out the candles on her cake. But I think what this is really about is the Germans want to try and help Cameron recover from Juncker becoming the Commission President. So they want to help the British get a good job in the Commission, one of the plum posts. But Cameron hasn't decided who he's going to send. And you can't dobby for a big job until the rest of Europe know who you're sending.
Shouldn't Cameron have decided this ages ago?
Completely. This is total essay crisis stuff. And Cameron initially planned to send Andrew Lansley. I think he saw this as a way of making up to his old boss from Conservative Central Office, who he was going to shuffle out of the cabinet at the next reshuffle. Here's the consolation prize. Go to Brussels and have a lovely time as European Commissioner. That idea now seems to be dead. I mean, they've realised that they will get a pretty rubbish job if they send Lansley. So they are now desperately casting around for an alternative candidate.
Is the problem that within Number 10 they can't decide whether it's a sort of favour job, a nice post for an old chum, or whether it's actually a very important role?
I mean, they have now woken up to how important it is. I mean, the other problem is, what they need is kind of Eurosceptic version of Nick Clegg. They need someone who's held a big cabinet job, who speaks lots of European languages and knows how Brussels works. There are very few people who tick all three of those boxes.
Isabel, who strikes you as a Eurosceptic Nick Clegg?
Well, I think James's point about Michael Howard's that actually he'd work well in this post, and he also, it wouldn't appear to be giving a job to your mate in quite the same way, although obviously Howard was instrumental in Cameron's rise to the leadership, so perhaps I'm being a little bit too kind there.
No, but Michael Howard is a former Tory leader, he's a former Home Secretary. He's clearly got the kind of CV that demands a big job. The rest of Europe would find it very hard to say, you sent us someone underwhelming, we're going to give you regional policy. I think one of the other things that Number 10 was too slow to wake up to is, if you look at the kind of people who are now being sent, the quality of commissioner is increasing quite dramatically. People are sending proper political players from their own country. I think one of the other revealing things about this is that Normanton was desperate to send a woman, because Jean-Claude Juncker had said he would have more women in senior positions than the Barroso Commission did. But so far, the Italians are the only country indicating that they're going to nominate a female candidate. But again, kind of Cameron, in his quest to promote women, he can't actually find anyone who he thinks he wants to promote.
Mm. What I think is really interesting about what you say in your column, James, is that the Germans are still suggesting that we may be able to get a decent job after all of the shenanigans over Jean-Claude Juncker. The fact that Britain isn't going to necessarily be relegated to one of the lower down commissioner posts, that, as you say in the column, the coveted internal market post still lies waiting. That's actually a massive relief for David Cameron, because one of the things that his critics in the Conservative Party were saying, even though they congratulated him on opposing Juncker's appointment, was that this would really harm Britain's prospects of getting a good and influential job.
The coveted internal market, but this is a single market.
Yeah, and it's so attractive for the British, because the idea is that you can use the power of a commission to A, push forward the kind of liberalisation that Britain wants to see, but also to stop the Eurozone countries from kind of ganging up on Britain about single market rules.
Yeah. And he's running out of time, isn't he, Cameron, now?
Yeah, he's got, if he wants a serious job, he's got until this summit, which is next week. I think it's a week today or a week tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that is not much time. And this, I think, is the big worry about Cameron, which is Europe, you have to do hours and hours and hours of spade work. And the worrying thing is, you can't go into this, you can't treat rewriting the European treaties like an essay crisis. You can't just pick them up and re-scribble all over them and try and make changes. You have to put in all the work beforehand. I mean, that's a real worry, but number 10 is too slapdash in its approach to some of these things.
Yeah. I think that's a worry from Eurosceptics and also Europhiles in the Conservative Party generally about Cameron's renegotiating strategy, that he doesn't seem to be doing enough of the groundwork now. So on the Commissioner, he hasn't been raising it in meetings far enough in advance. He certainly wasn't doing that with Juncker, even though he made a big stand at the end. He's very good at those last minute shows of drama, but he's not so good at that quiet groundwork that involves meeting up with people, seeing things coming down the line. And it's the same in domestic politics as well, that number 10 won't see something kicking up dust in the distance until it's basically on top of them.
And he doesn't seem to be very good at finding a woman he can trust, even though he clearly sees it as a problem.
I think that is not so much his fault, in that you know, some of the changes he put into parliamentary selection and the like, I mean, in 5 or 10 years' time, this will be less of a problem. But I think the Tory party's problem with women is a little bit like the England cricket team's problem post Ian Botham, which is the Margaret Thatcher is the kind of Ian Botham figure. And because you had Thatcher, everyone is looking for the next Thatcher. And so people are promoted, I mean, Theresa Villiers is a classic example of this. People are promoted too early. They're thrown in at test level when they're not ready for it. They have an awful start, and then their careers never quite recover from that.
Yeah, I love it when you break it down to cricket analogies. It makes it so much clearer for me. Moving on to sort of other politics issues this week, clearly... the child abuse inquiry has dominated the news. How do you think it's gone so far?
I think we are in a frenzy. We are in a situation where the government is essentially desperate. It's just trying to keep ahead of the mob. And frankly, all political parties are just trying to keep ahead of public anger. It's not a particularly dignified sight. I also think it's remarkable how little we've all... I think also the other thing that's going on is how there doesn't seem to be any kind of actual evidence here. There seems to be lots and lots of allegations, lots and lots of accusations swirling around. But there doesn't seem to... I'm not quite sure we've actually learned anything new recently.
I think one thing we have not learned, but which has become more of an issue, is the information that the whips held about MPs. So we've got this piece from our archive from 1995 of Michael Cockerell, who interviewed whips about how they operated in the 1970s. One of those whips in his documentary mentioned MPs in trouble with small boys and how the whips could help them in that situation. There are some MPs today, like Mark Reckless and Lisa Nandy, who are very interested in what the whips offices have known over the years.
Is there a sort of lingering idea of the establishment now, that the establishment is still at work suppressing evidence from 30 to 40 years ago, which is seems pretty extravagant.
Yes, I also think that the history of post-war Britain suggests that the British establishment isn't actually competent enough to conduct the kind of vast cover-up that has been suggested that it has done. And there's a kind of final problem here, which is I've just received a letter, for example, from someone alleging what seems to me a completely outrageous and outlandish claim about a public figure, not about paedophilia, but about them being a spy for a foreign country. Now, I must admit that I'm not planning after this to go off and investigate this claim. That's not because I'm part of some massive cover-up not to reveal spying for foreign countries. It's because it just doesn't strike me as a particularly credible accusation. I think a lot of what is going on here is that people went to people with information that just didn't seem credible to them, and they then didn't act on it. I don't think that's proof of a cover-up.
Or do you think the proof of a destroyed dossier or lost dossier is proof of a cover-up?
No, I think Charles Moore makes the point in the notes in the forthcoming Spectator, which is huge numbers of government documents get chucked, and the fact the Home Office can't find something from the 1980s, they can't find passport applications from a few weeks ago. I mean, I don't think this is in proof of malicious intent.
On to our final topic. Is it time that the government stopped subsidising the National Theatre? In the Spectator this week, Lloyd Evans suggests that it is. Lloyd, lay out your argument for us.
Well, I think that the National Theatre, which soaks up, I think, about £17 million of subsidy, it's causing, I think, a little bit of distortion in the West End, because it produces about 30 shows a year, and then the best of those are cherry-picked, and they go into the West End, and there are producers there, private producers, who will privately, secretly say to you that this is simply a little bit unfair and the playing field needs to be levelled. And there are other reasons why I think that the subsidy should be removed. One is that it seems a pity to impose this bureaucratic thing called the Arts Council in between the sponsor, namely the taxpayer, and the artist, and I think that distorts the whole artistic endeavour.
And you think there are workable models of sponsorship and that could be used?
Well, there are. I mean, there's some crowdfunding or collective funding, as it's called, and that's gaining ground, certainly in the theatre, musical theatre, and in publishing as well. And individuals are able to donate as much as they want. And in fact, it's more than a donation, it's an investment. And I think it would take about 36,000 people to invest £500 each to replicate the entire subsidy of the National Theatre. And they would not.
How credible do you think that is?
Well, I think there are 38,000 people in the country each year who would want to make a wedding gift or a baptismal gift or a birthday present or just make a private investment. And they would not only have the fun of knowing that they are effectively an impresario, they'd also have the possibility of backing the next war horse and seeing that money coming back, you know, tenfold, a hundredfold over the ensuing years. I think it's an attractive prospect.
Kate, do you think Lloyd's idea is practical, or do you think it's sort of right-wing lunacy?
It's not lunacy because it's right-wing. It's lunacy because it simply is impractical. First, I mean, let's start with crowdfunding. One of the problems with patronage in the theatre is that people want a reward for what they're giving away. And the moment that you you take the big names off the side of the buildings and let everybody give their £20 note, then you're spreading that sort of sense of benefit very thin. I'm sure giving your loved one a 20 quid bung towards the National Theatre isn't going to make them feel that much investment to the place. But to go back to the heart of Lloyd's argument, which is that it's distorting, that subsidised funding distorts the West End, I think Lloyd has a real point here. But I would also argue that our subsidised art sector supports the growth and nurture of most of the talent that then goes on to make us the big bucks in the West End. I mean, we have one of the biggest creative industries in the world, and to divide it up into the subsidised sector and the commercial sector is a completely false dichotomy. Take, for example, Mark Rylance. I mean, Lloyd Evans talks a lot in his fantastic piece in The Spectator about the Globe, which receives very, very little funding. Mm. But Mark Rylance, who for many years ran the Globe and has recently starred in Twelfth Night and Richard III, trained in the subsidised sector. Dominic Drongul, who runs it now, cut his teeth running a big building as the artistic director of the Bush Theatre. Mm. when we pull the plug on this subsidised talent, we're also pulling the plug on our future commercial prospects.
Lloyd, is that fair? I mean, does the state funding feed the private?
Well, I mean, these people would have had to train anywhere. If the National Theatre didn't exist, they'd probably trained somewhere else. And also there's the whole question of how much value training actually is. Training can help sort of shape talent, but it's no substitute for talent. And I think if you took this £17 or £18 million and you gave it to any theatre impresario, they would be able to set up a raft of projects, of theatre projects and shows that would be just as dazzling as the National Theatre. As for the idea that the National is some kind of hotbed of future talent, in other words, a sort of forcing house for Hollywood, I think our representation in Hollywood is simply a function of our position at the heart of the Anglosphere. Mm. And it's also a function of the peculiar reverence that Americans have for English acting, which is often rather misplaced, but there it is. I don't think that's got anything to do with the subsidised sector whatsoever.
Okay, do you think that there's a sort of snobbish assumption that the hoi polloi won't go for the highbrow, and therefore we need the government to support serious theatre?
Well, no, I don't think anyone at the National or in the subsidised sector would claim that. I mean, one of the remarkable elements about commercial success coming out of the National Theatre is that no one can really predict it. No one was sure that War Horse, which was in development for years, would be the hit it has become. And I don't think anyone would really call it populist, actually. I mean, it requires quite a sophisticated understanding of the nature of theatre and the world of fantasy. I mean, it's puppets about puppets dealing with death and war and horror. It's not, cats.
Mm. War Horse is an exception. You're absolutely right. It required a great deal of seed money to get it developed. And would it have happened without the backing of the National Theatre? Possibly not. But quite frankly, I wouldn't really shed tears over it.
The people who would shed tears over War Horse are the people.
Age 14.
Well, no, they're the people who you mention in your article, who are the royals. I mean, this is is a very, very funny article. This is the bit that really got me laughing, I'm afraid, which is where you suggest that the National Theatre needs to make more of its royal patrons, even to the point that one might bribe in the support of the Prince of Wales by serving Duchy originals at the upstairs restaurant.
Yeah, well, the royals would demand their cut.
Well, I think they can. I think at the moment they're getting their cut from lots of other places. I mean, I mention it because War Horse was famously sort of the only thing that the Queen's seen at the theatre recently in Yonks, or at least officially. God knows where she slips in. But I mean that to me is the really ridiculous suggestion. Not just because it's difficult to get royals to go to the theatre at all, but because actually the big the big money spinners, frankly, in the world of philanthropy, say the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, are already being assiduously courted by every charitable organisation out there. Mm. Even if, it was really that appealing to get their Duchy originals into the restaurant upstairs, they've got plenty of other museums and national heritage sites all across the country willing to do a deal.
We've seen with art and fine art that corporations are more than willing to sponsor these things.
Oh, certainly. And I think that's all to be encouraged. And I mean, one of the things, and I think I agree with Lloyd here, one of the things that really irks me is sort of lazy lefties jumping up and down because BP has sponsored the National Portrait Award, the Portrait Award at the National Portrait Gallery, for example. I mean, corporations should be setting a lead. And frankly, I don't think we should be snobbish about where their money comes from. If it's going to the arts, all to the better.
But you do think there's a room for public money too?
Yes, I think this has always been about public-private partnership. Where I think there is a real problem, though, is where you blur the boundaries between public investment and commercial profit. So one of the problems I have, for example, with War Horse, and also one of the areas where there was a lot of controversy around the RSC in the 80s and 90s with Trevor Nunn's musicals, is that the state puts in all of this investment. The show's a hit, and then it's taken to the West End and makes the director and the producer a fat profit. I think that's a national scandal. And if we are going to look again at funding for the National Theatre, I would argue we should look very, very closely at ensuring that if the taxpayer invests, the taxpayer should get its profits back.
And I mean, that scandal is exactly what private impresarios at the in the West End are complaining about. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I am completely as one with Lloyd on this. Yeah.
The View from 22 was produced by Sebastian Payne. You can read all the articles discussed in this week's Spectator magazine, available in newsagents and on the Kindle and App Store. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find more episodes at spectator.co.uk/podcast.